for me to win that day, it was special. So it was to have my father on my shoulder was amazing. So it was.
Did you get emotional, or do you get emotional?
Oh, I did. Yeah, no,
like
that day I got very emotional. I remember going over and giving him a hug, and
this the horse of your father.
My father, and I had a, the two of us cried. You know, just one of those days, and says we're too old to cry, but we cried anyway.
If there's one sport that produces more than its fair share of characters, you'd have to say that horse racing is right up there. People who add colour and maybe a bit of charm to a very tough and serious business. A lot of them are known by their first names or nicknames. Think of Lester, JP, Willie, Gordon, Ruby, Rachel, and how about this for a term of affection? Shark. Well, with me now is John Hanlon, known universally as Shark. You're very welcome to the Insights podcast. Now, tell me this. To survive in the world of racing, do you need to be a bit of a shark?
You have to be. You have to be. It's not an easy game. I think that, and it's getting harder. The expenses and everything in this game, it's gone very hard. But listen, you keep your head above water and keep trying, and that's the only way that you'll get make a living at this game.
So tell me, John Hanlon, the nickname Shark, I gather it has something to do with hurling.
Yeah, I'll probably remember Pat Dillon hurling Kilkenny years and years ago, or hurling in Kilkenny one even. Now, I wasn't the best hurler in the world, but I was awkward and I could stop a lad.
And you were a big man as well, the Bomber Liston
a little bit like that.
Christy Heffernan in Kilkenny, maybe.
I mightn't be the best hurler of all time, and in Kilkenny you had to be a good hurler to get on anywhere, but I was big and awkward. And I had big elbows and big shoulders. And I remember we playing inside in John's Park in Kilkenny one day, and semi-final of a league or something, and the ball came in and I think it hit up me or something, and I went out and the corner forward got a goal, and the next ball came down, I put my hand in Cahad and thrown it out to a lad coming in, and he got a goal. And next thing, Pat Dillon came in off the side of the field, and Pat was a great fella. And he said to the lad that was marking me, he said, "Will someone cut the F off the shark? If they don't, we can go home." And from that day to this, I'm called the shark. So it's and that's to be saying to you, what part of horse racing had it to do? It had nothing to do with horse racing. It was all over hurling.
And it stuck, and you like it, and you still like it.
Listen, my mother, I think, is the only one that calls me John. Do you know, no one knows my name, I'd say. You ask people, they don't know my name, but they know me as a shark.
And when you admit or agree that you do need to be a bit of a shark, I mean, how does that kind of show itself? How does it manifest itself?
Listen, with me, I do a lot of buying and selling. I was a cattle dealer all my life, and my family were a cattle dealer. As a matter of fact, Hanlon's Corner, you probably know here in Dublin, that was called after me, I think, my great-grandfather, because when he used to bring cattle up on the train, and that was his corner to sell the cattle. And that's the market was along there. And people had come from Kilkenny or from Cork or something, I'd say, for sure, we'd meet you at Hanlon's Corner there. And that's back years and years ago.
So it actually was a place where cattle were moved and traded and sold?
Yeah, milked cows. That's my grandfather used to, my great-grandfather always dealt in milked cows. And they'd come to Dublin here with maybe 15 cows, maybe drive them up the road or up on the train, drive them in as far as Bangstown with us or into Kilkenny, and put them on the train, bring them on up. And my father can remember being up around selling cows. And just the corner, everyone used to meet at Hanlon's Corner because it's just the middle of the market. And if you were meeting someone from Cork or from Galway or something, just got into the habit of saying, "Sure, we'll meet you at Hanlon's Corner."
And it was the bane of everybody, I suppose. We used to hear about it incessantly on the traffic reports, A Road Watch and that kind of thing in the mornings. But so you went into the cattle dealing business yourself then, maybe as a young fella, yeah?
I was dealing in cattle when I was 10 and 11. I went with my father to the marts in Kilkenny, and that's where it all started. My father was a cattle dealer. We were small at the time. We only used to deal maybe in 10 or 15 cattle a week. And then the older I got, the bigger we got at the game. I remember when the foot and mouth came in, however, 20 years ago, to go to 20 years ago, all the cattle business stopped. So when it stopped, we had to think of something else. And I was going out with a girl at the time, Rachel, which is my partner now. And we said that we'd try maybe one or two horses. She was working in Tony Mullins at the time. And I was doing a bit of work for Tony and for George. And we started with one horse. I'll never forget the first horse we had was a young horse. And you all probably know Dermot Weld. And Dermot bought the horse off me. And my barn at home, the first barn, is called Weld's Barn. And because Dermot Weld put it up and he popped the gallop for me and put up the walker.
You mean so he paid for it or he actually did it?
The horse, okay. the horse paid for it. So I did. I bought him for small money in Newmarket and at maybe £600 or £700. And I think at the time I got 60,000 for him. 20 years ago, which was a lot of money.
It was a fair amount of money. You had a horse as well. I think you tell stories about the Crazy Bishop.
The Crazy Bishop, yeah, he was an empty in a pub in Gordon, Pat Lachlan's pub in Gordon. At that time, I had him with Tony Mullins, and I bought him with a load of cattle, and brought him back to Tony's, and we were naming the horse that night, and I said, "There's only one name for the horse, the Crazy Bishop." I didn't think we'd get the name. But we got it. And the reason was the horse was by the parson. And he was out of a mare called Pixelated. And Pixelated means crazy. And the parson was the other end. So we called the horse the Crazy Bishop. And sure, it ended up, there used to be great laughs and yokes about him. But he was a lucky horse. He won a lot of races for me.
And he was not quite, you wouldn't call him an orthodox horse in the sense of the way he ran and that kind of thing.
Yeah, he was a crooked horse. And he used to throw his legs out like a duck when they're wobbling. And I remember one day turning in Clonmel, and a horse went to come up his outside, and he knocked him because his outside leg went out so wide it brought him down. So but he won a lot of good races.
But what did you see in a horse like that? I mean, if it didn't quite look the part.
That day I didn't see much because I went to buy a load of cattle off a man. And now this is 25 years ago. I went to buy a load of cattle off a man. And I had to buy the horse as well. They were all in the one field. So when I brought him home, I brought him down to Tony. And I said, "Tony, what do you think of this lad?" He said, "He's crooked as an ass," he said, "but maybe he'd be able to run." And he was able to run. That was 25 or 30 years ago. It's probably 30 years ago now.
You have a reputation of being able to spot a good horse and buy at a ridiculously low price. But I mean, there must be other horses that you buy and they don't turn out to be the winners.
They are. Listen, it's a little bit of a numbers game. You buy, like when I go to the sales there, I don't go and give 100,000 for one horse. I'd go and I'd give 30,000 for four horses. And if two of them turned out good, you'll get enough for them two to pay for the two that are no good, right? And get them away maybe to pony camping or something like that, you know? And the ones that are good, make use of them, you know? And like I bought Sky Ace there for £500 and she won a grade one for me. She'd be first grade one winner. I don't give an awful lot for horses. I find it hard to give an awful lot for horses.
What's the most you ever paid for a horse?
I think Philly bought Michael Mee has her now, and I think she cost 70,000. That was last year. And that was an awful lot of money for a horse. You know,
And why did you go that high?
Because I was told she's very good, and she is very good. I had word out of the stable that she was very good. And when I bought her, I had no one to buy her. And I said I'd have to go get someone to try and buy her. And she won in Galway for last year, and she won the Oaks in Down Ryle as well. So, listen, she's a good mare, so she is. And, like, for breeding, she's worth a good... When we're finished with her, she's worth a good quid to go back.
So, I mean, it's a good investment, then. That's how it's turning out.
Yeah, and definitely at this stage, because she has a black type and everything got.
So, tell me about... It's a kind of a phrase that's used, the touch. You've had a few of those, and you've admitted that sometimes I don't think the bookies like to see me coming.
No, listen, I like getting a few quid in that time, you know. It's handy to have it, you know, a bit of cash here and there. But
you're like the Connemara man who said to me once, he says, you know, "'Tis hard to bait a week's wages." It's kind of a statement of the obvious, you know.
Yeah, listen, you have horses there that they improve with age, and you'll have a horse there and he could have a couple of bad runs. The next thing, he just turns the corner and we'd set him up for a touch then, that, you know, he could be 16 or 20 to 1 and get your few quid, or I'd say to the owners.
But now, just explain that a bit more, like setting him up for a touch.
Setting him up for a touch is that you want to know that you have 20 lengths in hand, right? And if you haven't got 20 lengths in hand these days, you have no point in putting your money down, because there could be someone else doing the same thing and they might have 16 or 22 two lengths in hand, you know. So you have to have 20 pound in hand if you're going to do the job right.
And how often do you think the opportunity would arise to make that happen?
Maybe 3 times a year, you know. Like I'd back a few horses, but I wouldn't back mostly my own horses. And like, if I set up for a horse for a touch and he's not in the first four and you're running him in a handicap, I'm wrong. The trainer is wrong because he's done the job wrong. He don't know his horse. So when you go for a touch, like to finish, you get 20 to 1 and you have four places and you back him each way and he finishes third or fourth, you have your money back and a few quid with it, right? And if he wins, then you have the bonus. And I love that bonus bit.
I'm sure you do. But I mean, like, how important then is it, like, you know, sort of to keep shtum about how things are going? Because I mean, like, you go to any race meeting and there's always fellas kind of will have a quiet word in your ear and they'll say, oh, well, look, you know, I hear Shark has something good going in the 3:30 or whatever it would be.
You'll always hear that, you know. You'll always hear this horse is well fancied or that horse is well fancied. But to get the job done right, you should know and only yourself and the owner. And that's very important.
But there'd be people working in the yard would know it as well, wouldn't they?
They would, but if I heard back that they told something, they wouldn't be working in the yard long. Do you know? My grandfather gave me a great bit of advice years ago, and I'll never, ever forget it. I was coming out of the mart in Burris, and my grandfather was with my grandfather, and I was only about 12 at the time. And I was talking about this lad doing that, and that lad doing that, and this lad done that. And he said, John, he says, if you mind your own business, you'll have a business to mind. If you don't, you're in trouble. And it's very true.
Which was probably one of the most useful bits of education you got. What were you like in school, by the way?
Never went to Hoffman, I'll tell you the truth.
You never went that often?
No, it wasn't one place that I was fond of. It was a place that I used to get the bus all right down as far as Paulstown. And then I'd tum to Kilkenny or Carl or maybe in Escarty, where the marts used to be. And that even when we'd go home, then my father would land at the marts and I'd be there before him. And when we go home that even, then sure, my mother would be given out, you know, everyone would be here, and my father would be given out and I'd be given out. But I remember he'd always buy the paper that day, and when my mother would start giving out, you'd see the paper rising up to come up the way that he'd be behind the paper and no one could see him. You know?
She'd be giving out to you?
She'd be giving out to my father.
Oh, to him, I see. Right.
why'd you let him do that? Or why'd you let him do that? And sure, listen, my father, we got on great. So he's 86 years of age now, and he's still with us, thanks be to God, and he's living with us in the house. And my mother is with us in the house, and she's 82. And listen, we got on great. We all got on well together.
Right, and how did he feel, or did he give you any advice or make any observations when you said, look, you know, I'm going to get out of the cattle and move into the horses?
At the time, it wasn't a big... The cattle thing was after pulling a lot because the foot and mouth came into Ireland. There was no movement of cattle. And, like, there had to be a few quid got somewhere along the way to keep the thing going. And I was going out with Rachel, and she knew plenty about horses, and she's a big help to my business. And we started with one or two. When we started at home, a lot of people know my yard now, but when I started at home, we had two cattle sheds, and that was it. And then we got the horse sold to Dermot Weld, and we turned the cattle sheds into horse sheds.
Are there things from the cattle trade that you were able to apply to the horse business?
Yes, I think they are. If you're able to judge a good bullock, you should be able to judge a good horse. Now, that was Paddy Mullen said that to me years ago. You know, he said, anyone that can judge a bullock will judge a horse. And now with me buying a horse, I love a good walker. That's a big thing with me. Everyone watches them if they're turned in or turned out. A horse can be turned out, the feet can be turned out, can be turned in. But like, if you have a horse turned in or turned out, they're worth less money than the straight one. But it's not. No one ever says that they're worse than the straight one. Only they're harder to keep sound, right? And like, for the like of me, for the smaller lads, the smaller trainers, they buy them horses, win plenty of races with them, and because they're only half the price of the other ones.
Right, so it's a question you've got to work out the different balances and the opportunities
and
that might
the
be
price,
there.
You like, a good straight horse could be worth, this minute, a good straight 4-year-old or 3-year-old there is worth maybe 50,000. a one turned in or a turned out might be worth 15.
Right. You've been training horses then since more or less the start of this century, going back nearly 25 years, I suppose, at this stage. But I reckon that the first time a lot of people outside of racing may have heard of you was through the TV documentary about Rachel Blackmore. You gave her the start. Egg Don, was it by Davy Russell?
Yeah. Listen, I got my license training 19 years ago. And we had a little horse to run. And I was looking for a race in Turles, and I was looking for an amateur to ride it. And Davy Russell recommended her to me, and she went on and won it. And that was one of the days we got a bit of a touch, as a matter of fact. It was a little bit set up fairly well, so it was. And I'll never forget, I said, when you're going across the top, kick on, I said, and don't look back. I said, keep going and don't look back, because I didn't know her well. And like sometimes when you look back on a horse, you can get a horse on balance. And next thing, it began out the side door, and the money gone out the side door as well. And that'd be a disaster. But I'll never forget, she turned into the straight, gave the horse a kick, and he took off down to the second last. And she come into the last, she gave a no look to see what was happening. She couldn't hear anything behind her. And so she was 15 lengths in front, and she just straightened them up going down to the last of one. And that was the start of it. And after, I'd say a month after, she came to work for me. But listen, she was always very brainy and a great worker. Like, she was one of those girls that never mind working early in the morning or later. When she was working with me, she was going to college in Dublin, and she used to leave my place and go to college, do college from 5 o'clock in the evening till maybe 10 o'clock at night. And then come back down again, back down to Paso, and start the next morning at 7:30, 7 again. Like, not again the young people today, but they wouldn't do that.
No, she's not exactly an old woman now. I mean, be fair to her.
Yeah, well, she's not old, but like the people, you've young lads in the yard today, an awful lot of young lads in the yard today, 17, 18, 19 years of age, and they have no interest. You know, and it's gone very, very hard to get staff now. Like, years ago, there was plenty of staff around. But staff now for people to go ride a horse and yokes like that, they're next to impossible to get. You know,
but is it not something that people can do part-time, say, before they go to school or college in the morning? And it's a few quid for them then to set them up for social life.
You name one person, one young lad that wants to do that, they won't do it. You know, they just don't do it anymore.
And what do you think has changed?
I suppose times change and lives change, but I suppose everyone has too much.
And it's a tough life as well, Shark. I mean, you know, apart from getting up early, I mean, you can be working a lot in the cold. And, you
like,
know, it's...
I have great staff at home. Like, you take it, spilling rain, whatever it is, rain, hail or snow, they come in and they work. And there's never a problem with them. You know, there's never a problem, and you never hear anyone giving out about the rain or about the snow. They're all fit, wanting to come in, and they want to work. And the older people from 25 up are absolutely brilliant.
Mm.
But I think that the younger people over the years, and maybe I'm wrong what I'm saying, but I think that people years ago had less money, and everyone had to get out. I know I had to get out when I was young and go earning a few quid to keep the house going, maybe, you know. But now 95% of the people have plenty of money, and they don't go to work today, they don't care. And the thing about it now is that years ago you were fighting for your job. If you weren't in for a day or two, there'd be someone else to take over. Now you can come in on a Monday and you didn't bother coming in on a Tuesday. And if the trainer says something to that lad on the Wednesday, he'll walk out, he'll go down the road 2 mile and he'll get another job. And that's just life, and that's the way it's gone.
The other big break you got was after you liked the look of a horse that was for sale in the, I think it was in the Donoghue auction yard there in Goresbridge, the famous Hewick.
Yeah, listen, he's a dream horse, dream people's horse as well, because from the very beginning, I bought him as a two-year-old for 800 euro below in Goresbridge in Donoghue's auction at the time. Went to Goresbridge. As a matter of fact, I went down to Goresbridge to buy a different horse. And when I went down, the other horse wasn't there. He wasn't for sale. He didn't turn up on the day. And I was walking back out the back gate, met this horse walking in and just took a quick look at him and went on a few strips and looked back at him again and just liked him. And I went home, which we were only 5 minutes from Gorsebridge, sat down, get to dinner and raised it. I said, I saw a nice horse in Gorsebridge. And she said, what is he? I said, I don't know. She says, what age is he? I said, I don't know. She says, what breed is he? She said, I don't even know his number, I said. So, eating the dinner and go from the dinner and I said, here, I'm going back to Gorsebridge to see what this horse was.
This is obviously dinner in the middle of the day.
Oh, yeah. We always get to dinner. And down the country, you get to dinner in the middle of the day. In Dublin, you get to dinner in the evening. But down the country, you get it during the middle of the day. But I went back and sat below, waited for the horse to come out into the ring, saw him. And lucky enough, I bought him for £800, and which was a dream. From that day to now is a dream. Now, it didn't start a dream because everything went wrong. We went pint to pint with him. And the first day in a pint to pint, he got brought down and a horse fell in front of him and brought him down. The second day, it was a real wet day and he skidded along the ground below Boris House. And then the third day, with vexation, I ran him about a week later and the young lad in the yard fell off him. So everything went from a high to a low. I remember coming out the pint to pint the third day and we always thought that he was worth a lot of money as a 3-year-old, 4-year-old. And I remember saying to Rachel in the car coming home the last day he ran, I said, we've done a great job on him. I said, we turned £100,000 horse into nothing because he was worth nothing the third day we ran and not worth a penny. So I said, listen, we go to the track with him. We gave him a break, brought him back for the track. And he had a couple of runs and then went to Kilbeggan one day that he won. And there was a few quid got that evening as well.
Another touch.
We got back some of the money. So we did that. I'll never forget, we backed him that evening above in Kilbeggan at 33-1. And thanks be to God, he won and kept the thing going for another while. And that's all it does. You get a touch. And it keeps the show going on the road for another while. Like, the expenses in the racing game is so high.
Yeah, but he then went on to win the Galway Plate.
Yeah.
You took him to America. And then most recently, you had your Christmas dinner in a strange place.
I had, yeah. The first time that I had Christmas dinner at home ever in my life in Kempton, which was brilliant. But I'll go back to the Galway Plate first. Like, when you're growing up, when you're a young lad and you're interested in racing, this probably the race you want to win in Ireland is the Galway Plate or the Kerry National, one or the other, because they're the big ones. You know, they're the big national hunt ones. So there, and for us, it was great because my mother and father, we brought him to Galway. We put him in a house below in Galway for a couple of days and they were with us, you know, and for me to win that day, it was special. So it was to have my father on my shoulder was amazing. So it was.
Did you get emotional or do you get emotional?
Oh, I did, yeah. No,
like
that day I got very emotional. I remember going over and giving him a hug. And
this is the horse of your father?
My father. And the two of us cried. You know, it was just one of those days. And says, we're too old to cry, but we cried anyway. You know, it was just emotion to have him there. He was 84 at the time. And like, a lot of people don't have their father when they're 84, you know. So it was a big thing and big thing for me mother. And we went on from Galway then to Listowel. And we were very unlucky in Listowel. He was going to win the Listowel, the Kerry National. He fell at the last. He was after going in front and carrying top weight, which was a big test at the time. But listen, it's one of those things. And we went into Kerry National then. I remember the young lad who rode him, Jordan Gainford. And he was heartbroken after falling. And I said to him, don't worry. I said, we'll go to America with him.
And what put that idea into your head? The idea of going to America to win the, or to run in the American Grand National?
I was thinking about for years, I'd love to have a horse to go to Australia or to America and go over and do it over there. And this horse fitted the profile because he wants good ground. And he's not an over big horse, and he's a real easy going horse. So that meant then that you had everything you want for travelling. You don't want the horse to get excited on a plane or anything like that. And when I said I was going over there, the people over there were absolutely amazing the way they looked after us. But it was worth a lot of money. It was worth 250,000, and it was always in my mind if I had a horse to do it, you know. And we had the horse and we won. And it's amazing. It's a bit, there was 40,000 people racing that day in America. And there was an awful lot of Irish in America, right? And I remember going down to the ring and I was just standing, the horse were gone to the start. And these two people walked up to me and they introduced, one of them was from Donegal and one of them was from Longford. And they introduced themselves as two Paddies. And I said, "Are you long over here? Oh, 30 year and 27 year." They said, "We had to come see the horse. We heard so much about him from at home. We had to come see the horse." I said, "Do you live far from here?" "Oh," he says, "we're over 9 hours." So to travel that far to come see Hewick run in America.
People used to do things like that to see Barry McGuigan or Katie Taylor in a big fight. But
it was just amazing, so it was. And when the horse won, all the Irish came out, and the Irish were all together. Where there was about 300 of us out in the middle of the... there's no such thing as a stand where you get a cup. You get a cup at the winning line. And every Irishman I'd say that was there was with me, you know. And it's just great now. And I suppose at the time, it was a little bit emotional with little things that was after happening before that Jack the Bromhead.
I want to come back to that actually in a few minutes, Shark. But we better finish off with the Christmas dinner to come right up to date.
The Christmas dinner, we decided we were going to Kempton and my mother got sick a couple of days before that and she was in hospital. And I remember going in the day before Christmas Eve. We were to go Christmas Eve morning and she said, "Go on, go with the horse." And so we went on with the horse. And
because it was a big race.
Huge race. It's one of the biggest races in England. The King George, like, is one of those races that everyone wants to win. Everyone wants to win. It's worth a lot of money again. And we landed over with the horse on Christmas Eve night. And in fairness, they'd done a great job, Bian. They had Christmas dinner ready for us on the track. And they put us up in a hotel. You know, there was myself, Rachel, Paddy and Sean, the four of us went. But we had a great time. We had a great time and the way they looked after us was amazing. So,
and the win?
Stevens' day then, it looked like he was going to get beaten everywhere, bar on the line. But he's that kind of a horse. They went too hard. They jumped out. There was only six runners in it. But five of them were all front runners. So they all wanted to make the run. So we sat in behind. At one stage of the race, I'd say we were 10 or 12 lengths behind all the rest of them. Turning into the straight, he came with his run. And you'd say, "Oh, he's not going to get there." And then he was getting there. And when he jumped the last, there was only one winner. You know, it was all over when he jumped the last. And he ended up winning comfortable. And it was just amazing, so it was.
Well, what do you like before a big race like that or the night before? Would you have trouble sleeping?
You'll always have trouble sleeping with a good horse. Always. When you have every horse in our yard, you have good horses, you have middling horses, you have bad horses. But when you have the star of the show running, sleeping is not a thing.
It's his to lose.
Listen, the most, I tell you, you worry so much about the horse coming home. It's not the horse getting beaten. I don't mind the horse getting beaten. I don't mind Hughie getting beaten. But as long as he comes home and he's safe and sound. Like, it's the same as anything. But he's our star. He's in the stable.
So trouble sleeping, would it be difficult to live with as well?
No, not too bad.
Would you get cranky or anything like that?
No, not too bad. Now, if I was in bad form, I tell you, Paddy and Sean and Rachel, the three of them at home, that say if you're in bad form, keep away from for 10 minutes and he'll be all right then.
Right.
And that's the way. I have no begrudges. Even in the yard, if someone does something wrong for me in the yard, they get a bit of a telling off, right? But 5 minutes after, it's gone. And that's the way it should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, people like working with us because there's never roaring or shouting going on around the yard.
Yeah.
We keep things simple. And they know, bar to do something wrong, they won't get an eating. So if you know if you get an eating today and you do something wrong, well, you won't do something wrong tomorrow. Do you know what I mean? And, like, that's the way it is. We try and have a very friendly yard. Be always messing. The girls get an awful time every Monday morning because to be asked a lot of stupid questions. But I tell you, I do it on a Monday morning to get the yard going for Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, you know. And That's the way it is. You keep atmosphere in the yard. If you don't keep atmosphere in the yard, you're best straight away. Because the horses know. People say, a horse wouldn't know. Horse will know if there's people going around in bad form. A horse will know. Without a doubt they'll know.
How? How can you tell that they know?
Because they stand back at the back of the stable. If people start roaring and shouting, a horse will stand at the back of the stable. If there's no roaring and shouting, they'll all have their heads out over the door.
And like if people are laughing and chatting and cheerful.
That's okay. They don't mind it. Mm. They don't mind it.
So you had that win, but you didn't hang around in Kempton for too long. You were back in Leopardstown fairly quick, weren't you?
I was. I came home that night. I drove home the lorry that night. We said that we'd get going, get home. A good friend of mine had a box the next day in Leopardstown and he invited me up to it. And I said, I wasn't going to let him down either. So I ended up coming back and going up to the box and spoke to plenty of people in Leopardstown. Listen, when you're away like that, even when we were in America, we wanted to get home. You want to get home to your own people. And like, I enjoyed it, but they enjoyed it. And like, we have syndicates down there now at the moment, right? And we have one big syndicate, 90 people in it, right? And last Saturday morning, we had an opening morning for them 90 people. And they came down around the yard and everyone gets fed. When they come to our house, you get fed. You have to get fed. You have to get the tea.
I'm on the way.
Yeah. Well, everyone, no matter who comes to our house, all our life, from when I was a child, no one came to our house without getting something to eat. And it hasn't changed. No matter how many people is there, and the people who were there last Saturday and the Saturday before, there could be, on a Saturday morning in our house, there could be 30 people or 40 people. And they come at different from 8 o'clock until dinner time. And everyone gets fed. There's food for everyone, right? And that's the way it should be.
And there was a bit of controversy after you won the American Grand National. You brought Hugh into the pub.
We were all high and we brought the horse down for everyone to see. And sure, we had to bring him for a pint then. He was outside the pub, sure. It'd be only right to bring him in, so it would. But we brought him in and we spent only 3 minutes in the pub with him. And he drank his pint of Guinness. He drank his pint of Guinness. He stuck his head down the pint and drank half pint of Guinness over. And we brought him over then. The next evening, there was people there giving out that there's cruelty to animals and that. But listen, there was only 10 or 12. And as I said before, why would you talk about 10 or 12 people that have nothing else to do, only give out about something? There was hundreds of thousands of people that sent us cards, postcards, messages. I've a pile 3 foot deep of cards that we got. Just cards, well done, right? About going to America. But you'll always have 10 or 12 people there that never does that in their life. They're just trying to find out something to give out about. And that's the way I look at it.
I suppose people would be sensitive about the need to treat animals well. And you were like the controversy about Gordon Elliott sitting on the dead horse was kind of still fresh in the memory when and people are kind of wary of things like that, you know?
They are, yeah. But like, does people not think that we love horses? We're dealing with horses every day of the week. And them horses mean more to us. It's the same as someone dealing with people every day of the week, right? But like every morning, the loneliest day that you will ever have in your life in the horse game is when you go to a race meet and you have to come home with an empty box and you walk out the next morning and where that horse was in the stable, he's not there. It puts you down.
So that's because the horse has suffered a fatal fall,
yes,
or something,
yes,
and has to be put down.
Yeah, but that
and
is...
And have you had that experience?
Of course we had. Of course we had. Everyone has, right? And but they are looked after like pets. Like last year we had a horse in the English National and he got hurted. And it's a great story. The person that owned him was from America, right? I bought the horse for him. He was insured to go back to America. I had him insured for, it cost $300,000. And he was insured for $300,000, right? And the horse had an injury. The horse could have been put down in Liverpool, but the owner said no. And it took us 6 months to get that horse back right enough. Now the horse is in America, right? Having his time in America for the rest of his life. And that man thrown away $300,000 to save his horse. That's what people think of their horses. Do you know, every horse is looked after with us. They're looked after better than we're looked after ourselves. And that is the truth.
Before we leave the Hewick story, I mean, you were saying to me earlier upstairs that there were people made money out of it as a result of observing the religious duties around Christmas.
It's a great story. A priest up in Abbey Leaks, I met him in November in Cheltenham, and he was asking me about Hewick. And I said, listen, he's going to King George. And I said, he'll have a right chance. I said, he's 33 to 1. I said, he's a big bet. So I said, you should have a few pound on him. So he went and he had a few pound on him, and all his family had a few pound on him. But on Christmas Eve, he was saying Mass. And he said to the people when they were finished, he said, if you have a fiver left, he said, you should throw it on Hewick there on Stephen's Day. And I'd done the same thing on Christmas Day. And sure, the horse went and won. And he went down that evening to go pick up a few pound in Abbey Leaks with us. And he said there was a queue outside the betting office. They shut at 4 o'clock that evening because they had enough money to pay everyone. So we had the priest saying a few prayers for us going over. So I must get him down again before we go to Cheltenham.
Well, now, speaking of which, that's coming up fairly soon, Shark. So what are you're going to the Gold Cup and hoping for the best?
Listen, a Gold Cup is a Gold Cup, but last year he ran in the Gold Cup and was running a cracker when he fell. Fell at the second last. And I think he's in better form this year than he was last year. And I think he's after improving a good bit since last year. So fingers crossed that we go over there and bring back the glory. And hell, if we win a Gold Cup, it might be more in the pub he'll go into.
What does that mean? What could that possibly mean?
You'd never know.
And what about entry? I mean, could he go on then and run in the
National?
Yeah, but sure,
it's a month later to entry. And now the weights come out during the week and he has top weight in it. And he's not a big horse. But listen, he often carry top weight. He carried top weight in Galway Plate, in the Stole, in the Bet365. And he don't seem to mind top weight. So listen, if we had a good run in Cheltenham, he definitely got the National.
Tell me this much. I mean, again, somebody who knows nothing about your business, but I mean, how, in simple terms, how do you go about training a horse?
It's like a good manager in a soccer team or a good manager in a football team. The first thing you have to do is get the lads fit. If they're fit, they can go do things. But on a horse, it's the very same. You have to get them fit. And then you'll know what ability he has. But to get a horse fit is a big thing. Do you know, I often thought Jack Charrington would make a great horse trainer. Do you know, I did. He's like the like of that man was very good with people and very good at putting.
Yeah, and after that then, I mean, how do you get a horse then to peak when you want to get the best performance out of him?
That's the trainer. The trainer has to be good to do that, right? And you have to have fresh enough on the day and fit enough on the day. So, like, some lads train a horse right up to 24 hours before the run. 4 days earlier, I'd be taking pulls, maybe bring him to the beach, bringing him out for walks along the road. If you're having them fit within 4 days, they're not going to get fit in the last 4 days. So for a horse's mind, if he's going to the race ready and fit. Like, if you run today and run tomorrow and run for the next week, you'd be quite glad of a day off then.
Yeah, but right? I mean, going back to just the recent thing we were talking about, going over to Kempton on Christmas Eve. Now, I mean, you obviously figured the horse had enough time to settle and get right, despite going over on the ferry and being locked up in the lorry and all the rest of
it. Yeah, he's a simple kind of a horse. You know, travelling don't worry him. And now you'd have other horses that a bit different and they'd want to be there maybe a week beforehand. But I always find when I'm going to England, if I leave them as near to the race of all time, because some horses, I'll travel well and they'll eat and they'll drink. But then you'll have a horse and he's a nervous horse and he's trembling the whole way over to England, right? And when he goes over then, he's in a different stable and he won't eat and he won't drink. Whatever about eating, they have to drink because they don't get dehydrated. You know, and I've seen Willie Mullins and Gordon and all them lads taking out horses in Cheltenham that had chances because they haven't eaten up or they haven't drinking. And like, it's the same again. Like, we're talking about the welfare of the horses. Like, that's the same again. You know your horse And I've seen Garn, Willie, everyone taking horses over to Cheltenham, next thing on the day and not running them because they haven't eaten up or they haven't drink. And after costing plenty of money to get to Cheltenham, to not run the horse. It's a big thing to pull out a horse when you're going over there for a day and next thing it don't work.
Those trainers, they will be bringing over dozens of horses to Cheltenham and you know, lots of other meetings as well, and they can maybe have occasionally we'll have a clean sweep, be it in Leopardstown or wherever. I mean, is it good that there are some trainers that are so dominant? Is it good for the industry? I mean, what about the small guy?
Listen, I just think that the HRI has to...
That's the Horse Racing
Ireland. Has to put on more opportunities for the smaller people. Like, fair juice to Willie, fair juice to Gordon, to Henry de Bramhead. Do you know, you've these three or four big trainers that are taking over racing in Ireland at the moment. And fair juice to them, they all started from where anyone started. But the smaller guy has to get a living out of it too. And the smaller owner, which is very important, the smaller owner gets his day in glory. And I just think that there may be more races put on for these smaller people.
And what, is your idea that they would be barred from entering because they're too big?
Well, you could have it for trainers that didn't train 20 winners or 30 winners, right? And to knock out the top couple of lads. Like, they have plenty of day in glory, but why not let the small people have a couple of days in glory? And like, when you have small people, you have small owners, you have syndicates. You have syndicates there, 10 or 20 people. They want a day out of the races. And if they won't bother going if they know that their horse has no chance against the big one. So with what the race tracks and everything is losing out on this, you know. And I think there is plenty of opportunities. It can be done to help the smaller people, and I think it's very important.
You mentioned the three people in your life, most in your life, obviously, along with your parents, Rachel, and then your sons, Paddy and Sean. Paddy, they're both in the business, but more so Paddy in terms of riding horses.
Yeah, Paddy's only 16, and you see, in Ireland, you can't get a licence in Ireland until you're 17 to ride. So, in fairness to the kid, a couple of months ago, he decided to go to England and get a licence in England. So he's after riding a couple of winners in England, and he rode a second for me yesterday. Even he had the last five rides he had, I think he had 2 seconds, 2/3 and a fourth. Loves the game. Sleeps, eats the game, you know. Very dedicated to it. But he's tall. He's not going to be there for life. You know, in 10 years' time, Paddy won't be a jockey because he'll be too heavy. So I just feel that we have to let him do what he enjoys in life. And the other lad is there, and he's my social media manager. He's only 14. He's 13. He's gone 14 the other day. But he does everything that way for me. So
Paddy, he had a great trip to Scotland, I think, the year before last, and then you got some absolutely awful, tragic news on the way home.
Yeah, listen, we went to Scotland. He was pony racing, and himself and all his pals, his great pals from pony racing, and we were in Scotland. No Irish jockey ever won the championship in Scotland. And Paddy was the first lad to do it. But unfortunately, on the way home, we got a phone call. But poor Jack de Bramhead was after having a fatal accident below in Kerry. And I took a lot out of the chap. Took a lot out of everyone. And Heather and Henry, they're absolutely brilliant the way they coped with everything. And even to this day, I was talking to Henry yesterday, and it's just so tough. And you know something, every day that you get up and you meet, when I see my own young lad and the other two boys were so friendly that you'll always think of it, you know. I see even Paddy in his bedroom. He's now himself and Hewick are buddies. But on the side locker, there was a photo of Jack.
They were very close mates, weren't they?
Actually, they were great. Listen, I didn't realise that they were as close until he was gone, because Paddy said to me, he said, who am I going to talk to now in the night times? But with the computers these days, they were able to talk to each other every night for a half an hour or an hour. And when we were in America, Paddy had the horse, and I saw Paddy going off with the horse by himself.
This is the time of the Grand National?
The time of the Grand National. Mm. And I went down to him, and he was roaring. And it was all about Jack. And I just said to Paddy, I said, listen, I said, only for Jack, we wouldn't have won today. I said, it was him that won the race for us. Mm. So I said, always think of that.
The racing community, I suppose, like a lot of communities, it's good for putting its arms around people at times of grief and distress and tragedy.
It's amazing. We're all opposition to each other every day of the week. But if something goes wrong with anyone tomorrow morning, we're all there for each other. And that showed with Jack the Ramhead, with Heather and Henry. Like, they had a lot of support from the racing community, which is brilliant. Absolutely. For people that are so into the game and so into their own, just when something happens,
It is a sport with a lot of risks and dangers. I mean, jump jockeys or national hunt jockeys, they routinely break their collarbones, their arms, their legs, and sometimes, you know, sort of life-changing injuries for the worst. I mean, I remember just occasionally standing by the rails in Ballybrit and the sight and the sound of the horses going by. It really is awesome. It's frightening. I mean, you need a lot of courage for a sport.
It's the only sport in the world that they have to have two ambulances going around after. And that tells its own story, you know, because they can't have one, just gets one leg gets hurted and then it goes a bit farther and another leg gets a fall and gets hurted. So it says, I can't recall any other sport in the world that you have to have two ambulances. But listen, it's a great game and people love it.
But would you have any misgivings, though, about your young fella taking part in it like that? I mean, knowing what happened to his friend, okay, that wasn't over jumps or anything like that. It was a kind of a freak accident, I think, on a beach.
It was on a beach, yeah. Of course, every day that Paddy gets up on a horse, you're afraid. I'll tell you a little story. We were below on the beach in Ballybunion last year. And Paddy got a fall and he was on the ground unconscious. He had to be airlifted to Tralee Hospital. And I remember Rachel ringing me. She was gone racing and she said, well, how's he getting on? I said, he rode the first winner. I said, he's here in front of me. I'll talk to you later. And he was unconscious on the ground and I never said a word, you know, but he was okay and he was perfect. He came out of it perfect. But everyone gets
falls. Did she just ring you by chance?
She rang to see how he was getting on.
All right.
And my mother rang to know how he was getting on. Now, I didn't tell him a lie. He was in front of me and he was after riding the winner in the first race. But hella, my heart was in my mouth. So he got airlifted to Tralee Hospital. But thanks be to God, everything worked out. But like, there's chaps there getting falls every day of the week. They're breaking their arm, they're breaking their collarbone, and they all want to get back at the game straight away. So that tells its own story in my eye.
You've spoken before about how your yard isn't so much a racing yard as a buying and selling one, and point to point is obviously important to you.
Yeah, point to point scene is very, very important to us. It's very important in Ireland. There's a lot of big turnover in Ireland and putting an awful lot of people. Like, if you took what people work in the pint to pint game or in the racing game. Like, the racing game is probably one of the biggest turnovers, I'd say, in Ireland, right? But I buy and sell, that keeps me yard going. Training horses, I earn no money out of training horses. But selling horses, buying horses, I love going to the sales. I miss no sale and buying one or two, coming home. And then it's a task for me to get them to go win.
And you talk about syndicates. You've won, I think you mentioned you had 90 members in it. I mean, that's and it's something you've promoted in the last few years. People can get in on the act, as it were, for maybe €1,000.
Yeah, it's a great syndicate, so it is. And we have another one starting up at the moment now. It's €1,000 all in for the whole year. And this is for the people that can't afford to put a horse in training. Like, it's not, put a horse in training is $2,000 a month or $1,700 or $1,800 a month, right? And a lot of people can't afford that. But £1,000, and that covers you for the whole year with two horses.
Well, that gives you 90,000, we'll say, if you have a syndicate that big. So there's 90,000 in it for Shark. What's in it for the guy who's putting in the 1,000?
I tell you, the two horses are costing 70,000. Right? The two horses cost 70,000. I ended up keeping shares myself because I didn't sell fully the syndicate. So, and it costs 15,000 a year to keep any horse. So, like, you're only getting out of it, but you're getting to meet people, and you never know how that syndicate, which has happened, five out of that syndicate will buy another horse, right? So, but the people that are in that syndicate, they're not coming in to earn money out of it. They're coming in to have fun. And as I said last Saturday morning, there was 15 below in our house, and they were in the kitchen, and they were in the sitting room, the river, because it was raining. And the crack they had, between theirself.
And but they, you wouldn't expect them, or they wouldn't expect, or you wouldn't lead them to believe that they would actually get a return on their grand. It's just a question of joining a club and they can maybe get into a parade ring or something.
Well, I don't know what you're doing. You're joining a club there with me and you're going to have at least 16 or 18 days a year and going racing, getting your ticket to go in racing, standing in the ring and enjoying the crack. And I'll never forget the first night this horse ran in Dundalk. We went up and there was only about 25 in there or 30 in there. But I said, here, it's the first time I said, I want to buy you all a drink. So I went into the bar and bought him a drink. And after the second race, and I said, we'll be going home now straight away, do you know. After the last race, 3 hours later, we're still in the bar with a lad singing and a great atmosphere, do you know. And that's what it's about.
It's being in a club.
It's being in a club and it's not costing you a fortune.
Would it be fair to say racing, it's a bit like buying shares. You should only engage in it with money you can afford to lose.
I always say that when you put money into a horse, you have to be able to afford to buy the horse to put the money in. If you haven't, you shouldn't buy it to think that you're going to earn money of it. And it's the same with the syndicates. Like, you're putting in £1,000, right? And that £1,000 has gone in to pay for the horses or whatever, right? And train fee for the first year. And you want to be able to afford that £1,000. If you don't, you shouldn't be in the horse. But what people do is that two people, I'd sell you a share for £1,000 and you'll sell half of that to that for £500. So yourself and him can go racing together, right? And have a great day out. And like everyone works hard. But to go to the races for a day, go to Leperson, go to wherever, right? It's always a great day out and people enjoy it.
Do you have a favourite race course?
Fairy House, my luckiest race course. Fairy House, very lucky in Fairy House. A lot of winners in Fairy House. Listen, I suppose my favourite race track is Gordon beside us. As my mother says it takes 5 minutes to get there and it takes a day to come home. So, and that was like last Saturday in the Red Mills day. We were no length getting there, but it took a long time to come home.
Well, listen, long may you continue to enjoy the business, which you clearly do, and continued success to you. John Shark Hanlon, thank you indeed for your insights.
Listen, thank you very much. Thanks for everything.
To hear more in this series, go to rte.ie/podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts.